sneaking around before Isaac sends Jacob off to the house of his uncle to find a wife, and from among his cousins, and after stopping to sleep and having an amazing vision and setting up a memorial to the Lord, we see him now at the start of chapter 29. So Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the people of the east. He looked and saw a well in the field, and behold, there were three flocks of sheep lying by it, for out of that well they watered the flocks. A large stone was at the well's mouth. Now all the flocks would be gathered there, and they would roll the stone from the well's mouth, water the sheep, and put the stone back in its place on the well's mouth. And Jacob said to them, "My brethren, where are you from?" And they said, "We are from Haran." And then he said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" And they said, "We know him." So he said to them, "Is he well?" And they said, "He is well. And look, his daughter Rachel is coming with the sheep." Then he said, "Look, it is still high day. It is not time for the cattle to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go and feed them." But they said, "We cannot until all the flocks are gathered together and they have rolled the stone from the well's mouth. Then we water the sheep." So, okay, so Jacob starts his travels with a little skip in his step. It says the words, "Jacob went on his journey." And it's more literally translated, "Jacob picked up his feet," or "lifted up his feet." And so clearly he was a bit energized by having just met the Lord and, you know, his ladder vision. And he had to feel a lot better knowing that the Lord is on his side now, that's with him in his travels, watching over him, you know, promising that he would return safely back to the land he came from. And one commentary I read mentioned that the trip from Beersheba to Haran was about 450 miles. Which is pretty long way. And if he walked even 30 miles a day, it would have taken him 15 days to get there. That's a long walk. Quite a daunting trip, and yet he has a skip in his step. So that's pretty impressive right there. And then he sees the well with the flocks of sheep, and he goes over to it, and we don't know what the landscape looked like. Most likely he saw the sheep way before he saw the well. Because if you've got big flocks of sheep, the well's going to be in the midst of them. And we're assuming that he saw three shepherds because it said there were three flocks there, which is, you know. And then the well that he saw was not a common sight. We've learned in the past with Isaac how hard it is to find wells in this area. And the way it was described in the wording, it was a well that was dug as opposed to a cistern or a spring with running water. So that it was out in an open grazing field. The field that was described is actually the same as the fields that Esau used to hunt in. So they were like grazing fields. They weren't, you know, fields that were being cultivated or anything like that. And it didn't seem like there was any city or town nearby because he didn't mention anything. I mean, that. It said, go back to my scripture, so I'll have the page back, but it said he came to the land of the people of the east, but it doesn't say what it looked like or anything like that. So we're just surmising from what he's looking at that there isn't a whole lot around. And, you know, we can imagine as a child that his parents had to tell him, you know, plenty of times, "Oh, you know, we met at a well," or, "My father's servant met my wife at a well and brought her back," and, you know, the whole story and all of that. So, you know, I'm sure he was thinking in his mind, "Well, a well, well, it's a good thing. You know, maybe I'll find somebody here." And I was a little different, though, because the well that the original servant went to, I forget which one he is, Eleazar. That's what I was going to say, but okay. But when he went, it was in a city, so he was expecting the women to come out and be at the well. This was a well where sheep were watered in the country, so he had no idea if anyone would be coming along at all. And what he saw when he got there was, you know, shepherds. So, you know, that, you know how that works. And notice again that the well was covered by a stone. It said a heavy stone. And they used that in those times to protect against pollution and obviously to keep your enemies from filling your wells in or dumping stuff in them to pollute them, all those kinds of things. And I also read somewhere where it might also keep the lambs from falling in. Mm. You know, if you think about it. Mm. Lambs, sheep aren't the smartest of animals, so, you know, there's a good chance that that could have been a possibility. And then we see here that Jacob is the one who gives the greeting and to these three waiting shepherds, and he wants to know, well, where am I? Mm. Right? He's trying to figure out his location and whether they know his uncle Laban. And one thing we should notice is the change in his character. Now, Jacob was known to be a mild man. His brother Esau was the one that traveled around and hunted and did all these things. But Jacob was the one really known to just sort of hang around the house, hang around the tents, and do whatever he did there, which we really don't hear a lot about. You know, but finally he's showing some backbone here. And he's even getting a little pushy in this talk. He's checking to see if he's in the right place. And then he says something interesting to them. He says, water your sheep and then take them somewhere else to feed them. And, you know, does he think they're lazy, waiting for this, whoever's supposed to come help them? Is there someone else coming to help them remove this stone? And are they waiting for the woman to come help them? Are they too weak to move the stone? You know, is there some other motive? You know, does he want to be alone at the well with Rachel? You know, without anyone listening or seeing what's going on? And then they make it clear that it's a custom that everyone waters the flocks at the same time. And that, you know, we don't know if Uncle Laban owns these flocks or if they're owned by someone else. It could also be that they're waiting for Rachel because they need to pay to use the wells or to give some kind of gifts or whatever it is. So, I mean, the writer's not clear about any of that. And we'll never know for sure what Jacob was thinking, but at least he's in the right place at the right time. And hopefully he's giving thanks to God for the fact that this woman is about to approach. You know, it couldn't be a coincidence because God doesn't have coincidences, you know. So it's definitely providence, and, you know, Jacob's there at the right time. So in verse 9, now while he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. And it came to pass, when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Jacob went near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's relative and that he was Rebekah's son. So she ran and told her father. Then it came to pass, when Laban heard the report about Jacob, his sister's son, that he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. So he told Laban all these things, and Laban said to him, surely you are my bone and my flesh. And he stayed with him for a month. Okay, so first of all, Rachel comes, and her name, actually, she's a shepherdess, and her name means ewe lamb. In other words, here comes the sheep, the lamb with her lambs. Okay? Interesting that's the case. And, you know, there's no mention of love at first sight, but in a fit of excitement, Jacob picks up the stone by himself. And, you know, we don't know if it's a burst of adrenaline or testosterone or, you know, but Jacob rolls away this heavy stone that everyone's been waiting to be moved all by himself, and he waters Rachel's sheep, which had to take quite a bit of time. He seemed overwhelmed with joy to see her and was probably thinking, wow, God really came through for me. You know, the other shepherds were probably not so thrilled to be outdone by this stranger, although we don't know that. And maybe we're feeling a bit sheepish. Mm-hmm. Sorry, but I had to do that. Come on, Pastor Nick would have done that. So, you know, Rachel's probably watching these things unfold and thinking, who is this guy? He's a nut job. You know, what's going on here? You know, and then he kisses her. He kisses her. Now, it's not the romantic on the lips, passionate kiss. It's a kiss of familiarity that was probably, and even with the language, it was probably a kiss on the cheek or both cheeks. And, you know, like the type of greeting you give a relative that you hadn't seen or hadn't ever met in a long time. And this is the only place in the Bible where we read of a man kissing a woman that is not his wife or his mother, which I thought was interesting. He's met his flesh and blood family and couldn't wait to show his joy, and he even cried out loud and wept. Now, I don't know, a lot of you are Italian, and or I was married to an Italian, and you know that when you get together with the relatives that you haven't seen in ages, everybody's screaming and crying and laughing and yelling and shouting, and I mean, that's what it was like. So, I mean, that's what this scene was between him and her, and she's probably thinking, okay, this is creepy. And he finally turns around and tells her who he is. It took him a while, obviously. He kissed her first and cried. And, you know, it's good that he did that because she's a shepherdess and she probably has this big staff in her hand. And at the very least could have taken him out, you know, if she didn't realize what his intentions were. And he started, you know, getting a little touchy-feely in that way, even though it was just a kiss. Yeah. You know, people just didn't do that in that time. So, you know, and obviously if her father trusted her with the sheep to be out and about by herself, she was a strong woman. So, you know, I think it was pretty bold of him to take that chance and kiss her. And so immediately she runs to tell her father, Laban, about Jacob. And the fact that it says that she ran home to tell him meant that they couldn't have lived very far away. Even though it doesn't say that he saw any kind of dwellings or anything like that, but, you know, how far is she going to run, first of all? Second of all, she's not going to leave her sheep for very long. Because even though the other shepherds were there, I mean, they could have all left with her sheep too if, you know, depending on who they were, we don't know. So it couldn't have been very far from her house to or tent, whatever it was, to where Laban was living. And, you know, so we don't know how far it was. But then Laban comes running to meet Jacob and gives him a warm welcome. Now picture the imagery going through his head when he finds out, and he starts thinking, well, the last time we did this, there were 10 camels and gold jewelry and a rich dowry. And so he's got all this going on in his mind, I'm sure, and he thinks of Rebecca and the rich Isaac and, you know, that she married, and, oh, well, they must have sent someone in the same manner, you know. And and after hearing Jacob's spiel, you know, when he gets to meet him finally, Laban's enthusiasm probably cooled off pretty quickly because he's just one guy. He doesn't have anything. He walked. He didn't even have a donkey or anything. You know, he's just on his own. And, you know, he, like Pastor Nick said last week, you know, he probably had one of those sticks with the, you know, tied up bunch of stuff in it and, a bag of water, and that was it. You know, so I can see that thought process, you know, of, but he says, all right, you know, come back. He invites him back to stay with them, like any, you know, good family would do for a traveling relative. Oh, well, come stay with us for a little while until you get your bearings or whatever it is. Meanwhile, you know, Jacob has told him, look, I'm here for a wife and all of that, but Laban's probably thinking this is crazy. And, you know, I can see that, great, a relative I have to put up with until we figure this out. So, you know, he's thinking, where's the dowry? How's this guy going to do anything for my family? How can I, you know, give my daughters to him? He's got nothing. And, you know, a month goes by, but at least Jacob has his foot in the door now. And, you know, the bone and flesh comment should have reminded Jacob a little bit about the apple. Because, you know what we say, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And based on the history of his family, even his own name, Jacob should have at least thought a little bit about the deception that had gone on in his bloodline. you know, can't we hear, we can hear Isaac saying, oh, you remember that time I said you were my sister, and boy, we really got out of that one, didn't we? You know, so, I mean, none of this is going through Jacob's mind, right? And we always tend to conveniently forget the things in our family tree that we don't want to remember. But sometimes we need to look into that tree and prune the stuff that we know shouldn't come down the line any further. And that's really important, you know, because if we look at the fruit, sometimes it isn't the fruit we're expecting. And, you know, maybe that limb needs to go so that we don't get more of that fruit coming down the family line. So then in verse 15, then Laban said to Jacob, because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? So he's a month that he's been working for this guy for nothing, right? Tell me, what should your wages be? Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were delicate, but Rachel was beautiful of form and appearance. Now Jacob loved Rachel, so he said, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. And Laban said, it is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to another man. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. Then Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go in to her. And Laban gathered together all the men of the place and made a feast. Now it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to Jacob, and he went in to her. And Laban gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came to pass in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, what is this you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served you? Why then have you deceived me? And Laban said, it must not be done so in our country, to give the younger before the firstborn. Fulfill her week, and we will give you this one also for the service, which you will serve me still another 7 years. Then Jacob did so and fulfilled her week, so he gave him his daughter Rachel as wife also. And Laban gave his maid Bilhah to the daughter Rachel as a maid. Then Jacob also went in to Rachel, and he loved Rachel more than Leah. And he served with Laban still another 7 years.
Wow.
Okay, so first of all, he's there a month, and his uncle's treating him basically like a slave because he's not paying him any wages. So, you know, that's not a very nice thing for an uncle to do. But we know Laban. So he finally offers him wages, and, you know, he's trying to appear generous. And clearly, Jacob must have told him, and he's there to seek a wife, and Laban's thinking, well, what can we get out of this situation? So Jacob shows up, no dowry, he's alone, and not even the mention of one, from what we can tell, where a dowry would come from, whether his father was going to send something. I mean, there was nothing. And of course, Laban has these two daughters, Leah and Rachel, born in that order. And they call them the older and the younger, which is interesting. They don't say the firstborn and the secondborn, which is something, I guess, with the women, it's a little different than with the boys. But, you know, Leah is an unfortunate name, since it also means weary, but can also be interpreted as a cow.
Cow?
Ouch. A couch. So the text describes her as having what they call delicate eyes, more properly translated as soft, tender, or maybe weak. We don't know. You know, it could mean that she's tender or kind-hearted, but this was certainly not the description of a beauty that, you know, that Jacob's thinking about marrying. And Rachel, on the other hand, is described as beautiful in both face and figure. So quite a difference between the two girls. And so Jacob puts his heart right on his sleeve and asks for Rachel's hand, which, you know, and he offers to serve 7 years, which is actually longer than the prevailing dowry period of the time. Normally, a dowry at that time would have been 3 or 4 years' wages. So he was offering 7. That's a pretty big bonus for Laban right there. So he's already shortchanged himself.
The deceiver is
right there.
Deceived.
Right.
Yes, well, exactly. He deceived himself and he, you know. And then again we see this younger sibling conflict stirred up by Jacob's choice of Rachel. You know, how many of us have heard or been or seen, you know, the older sibling that, you know, the younger one got married first, the younger one had children first, the younger one did this first, the younger one did that first, and, you know, they were mocked or shamed, and look at the grief that it caused Isaac and Jacob in his own family with his own deception, right? I mean, he tore the family apart, they all tore the family apart, just with that deception between Esau and Jacob. So here we see it happening again. And, you know, Jacob served his 7 years, and he, you know, he's thinking, all right, you know, it's almost 7 years almost up, and I'm going to get Rachel, and it's going to be great, and we're going to be married, and all of that. And, you know, love really blinded him to the struggles of daily life, which made it seem go by quickly. You know, but at the end of the time, Jacob pretty much demanded that his uncle give him his wife. You know, I mean, they were betrothed, obviously, during that time. But, I mean, they weren't living the married life, you know what I mean? So, you know, Laban's milking the situation for whatever he can get out of it, and Jacob is, you know, stewing until the point where he can finally be with his wife. And we don't hear anything about Rachel or how she feels about any of this. But, you know, women in that time really didn't have any rights to question their father or do anything. So it's not surprising that she's not speaking up, saying, I want my husband already. And maybe she didn't. We don't even know. Hmm. You know. But hopefully they have learned to love one another. And then finally, Laban agrees, and he throws this big wedding, wedding bash, or wedding celebration. And the literal translation of that is like a drinking party. So Jacob receives his bride. You know, only it's not Rachel. He's been deceived into consummating a marriage with the older sister, Leah. And, you know, I wonder what this sounds like. You know, Jacob is reaping what he sowed in his own life. And imagine the scene. You know, Jacob's probably a little, more than a little drunk. And, you know, the sisters may not have even been at the party, because a lot of times they don't bring the bride in until the moment of truth, you know, at the end, when they drag her into the tent. And well, some go willingly, some don't, you know. But in those days, you know, everything was an arranged marriage. So, you know, we don't know if she, we don't know how Leah felt about any of this. Right? You know, and maybe they were at the party, but they weren't dressed for the bridal event. You know, either way, they all wore veils in those days. So the only thing you could really see, maybe, was their eyes. Sometimes they even wore things across the eyes so that you couldn't really see in. And then we go to the wedding tent, and Leah's, you know, probably dressed like her sister, probably not saying a word because she's probably nervous or terrified or whatever about this whole thing. And I imagine she borrowed her sister's perfume and maybe her sandals and eye makeup, if he could see that, and anything else that would conceal who she was. You know, because obviously she's going along with whatever her father told her to do. So when Jacob woke up in the morning glow of the sun, illuminating his tent and gazed upon his beloved, it was the uncomely Leah. What he said to Leah, we can only guess. But he had probably whispered Rachel's name all night to her, you know, 100 times. And she went along with it and played her sister, you know. And as one commentator said, this is soap opera ugly. I mean, imagine that. You wake up and you're with someone you didn't think you were going to be with. And knowing Uncle Laban as we do, you know, Rachel was probably told, look, here's how it's going to go down. If you ever want to marry Jacob, your sister's going to go first. And when she's done, you know, then it's your turn and you'll keep your mouth shut or you'll never marry him. You know, and you know, all he's imagining is, well, what else can I get out of this kid besides, you know, I've gotten my 7 years, maybe I can get 7 more. You know, and he couldn't care less about making Jacob happy or making his kids happy. You know, that's probably the thought process he's going through. And then, so, of course, you know, next morning, Jacob confronts Laban. You know, and basically he's forced to drink some of his own medicine. You know, he dished it out, now he has to take it. And, you know, it was customary in those days to celebrate a wedding for a week. So they would have the wedding night, and then for the next week, everyone would celebrate, and the drinking would continue. And you saw, even with Jesus at Cana, you know, they ran out of wine because, you know, the party was going on, people drinking more than they thought, and, you know, they ran out. So, I mean, that's the situation that Jacob's in right now. You know, he can't make a big stink out of this in front of everybody because he's going to embarrass his father-in-law, he's going to embarrass his wife. You know, Rachel probably also, you know, so what's he going to say? He can't really say a whole lot. He certainly publicly couldn't say anything, you know, so he probably pulled Laban aside, you know, but he does complain. And of course, Laban throws in the ugly, the firstborn has to be first, you know, scenario. And who is Jacob to argue about that? You know, he has a brother waiting at home to kill him because he usurped his firstborn position. So he knows what that's like. And so he can't say anything, but he's still madly in love with Rachel. So, you know, having Leah as a wife isn't going to change that. And so Laban offers him Rachel in trade for 7 more years of service if he agrees that he'll wait a week, finish out the week with your first wife, and then you can marry the second one. And, you know, what could he do? Mm. You know, his Laban's deception really cut to the heart of Jacob. Mm. You know, because his own sin was being thrown in his face of what he had done. Mm. And talk about heaping coals on somebody's head.
Mm. You know, it's interesting. He must have been a man of his word because Laban gave him Rachel before he served the 7 years.
Yes. Mm. Yes, that's his only consolation, is that he gets her then, instead of having to wait the 7 years.
But he could have, like, taken off, maybe.
Well, he could have. He could have just said, look, Leah and I are leaving, and see you later.
Isn't, though, a week, like, mean 7 years? Like, you know, when you're talking in,
prophetically,
times?
Yes. In this situation, no.
No? Okay, no. I wasn't sure.
No, they're not going to celebrate a wedding for 7 years.
No, I mean, no, not that.
No,
I mean,
they had
to wait a week. Didn't it say something?
Well,
about
Laban,
a week?
Yes, it said. What it says is that they celebrate for a week the wedding.
Right.
So he sleeps with his wife the first night, and then the partying goes on for another week after that. So what Laban is saying, after that week's up, then you can start again with your other wife.
No.
With
so
Rachel.
He didn't have to
well, no, he years. Said you don't have to wait the 7 years to sleep with Rachel, but you have to give me another 7 years of your life,
okay.
Is what he basically said. And then, but he, notice he also didn't throw a big wedding party for Rachel either. You know, Leah got the party, Rachel just got the, you know, the consummation of the nuptials, and that was it. You know, so that's an interesting thing. And, you know, so unwittingly, Jacob subjects Rachel to the same treatment that his brother got. Because it says, I just want to read this because I think it's important. Sorry, because my notes are so split up. Okay, so Jacob fulfilled her week. Then it says later, Jacob also went into Rachel, and he also loved Rachel more than Leah.
Mm-hmm.
So Jacob's true love became the also wife through Laban's deception. Rachel was only the second wife, a fitting answer to Jacob's own treachery. When he usurped the birthright of the firstborn brother, making him the also son. So Rachel, now being the second wife, doesn't have the same rights as the first wife. And I think that's really fascinating. I never really thought about that before. But because of that, the children's positions also are affected. And, you know, so what's happening to Jacob through all this? He's really being refined, right? Where are those angels descending and ascending now, you know, where's that ladder happening? And, you know, has God given up on him? You know, at first maybe he thought that was the case, you know, but what's really happening is Jacob's character is being refined in the fire of deception, right? He's growing in faith that God's going to bless him if he's willing to wait, because God promised to bless him, right? I will bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you, and I will bless you and make you a great nation, all of those things. And so he's growing in patience as he's working off this dowry. He's learning to be a man of who's a good, hard worker, right? All of these things, and he's being disciplined for his own actions. And he's learning maybe to have a little better judgment and wisdom the next time he makes a big life-changing decision.
Yeah, I see it as a case of him being the recipient of the deception, and now it's working in him to where now he knows what it feels like to be deceived.
Exactly.
So it's bringing that change in him that, well, no more deceiving people.
Yeah, because he's going to think twice the next time, you know, when he tries to pull a stunt like that, right? Mm-hmm. And here, you know, we picture Laban, he's probably patting himself on the back for what he accomplished, when in reality, God was the one that was working everything together for good for Jacob in his life and preparing him for his future. And you don't think about that, but, you know, like everything else in life, we have to go through trials in order for God to refine us and teach us and give us good character.
Yeah.
And so that's what Jacob's going through here. You know, as painful as it seems, you know, it's stuff we have to go through if we want to become more like Christ. Mm-hmm. And so now Jacob has two wives.
Poor guy.
Two wives. Two sisters. But he played favorites from the start and everyone knew it. Mm. And it's hard enough to get married, so imagine marrying two people within a week's time. Tensions had to be running high in Jacob's household. And he now had four women that he was contending with, because he had his two wives and their two maids. And you know how that works. The maids usually take the side of the wife they work for. And so there was, you know, two going at it and then all four going at him. And, you know, stirring up sibling jealousy is never a good thing, ever. And there's an interesting note about this. The Levitical law in chapter 18, verse 18, forbids a man from marrying two sisters. And you shall not take a woman as a rival wife to her sister, uncovering her nakedness while her sister is still alive. We know this can't be good, right? So then we come to verse 31. When the Lord saw Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. So Leah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Reuben. For she said, the Lord has surely looked on my affliction. Now, therefore, my husband will love me. Then she conceived again and bore a son and said, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son also. Mm-hmm. Now, this time my husband, and she called him his name Simeon. She conceived again and bore a son and said, now this time my husband will become attached to me, because I have borne him three sons. Therefore, his name was called Levi. And she conceived again and bore a son and said, now I will praise the Lord. Therefore, she called his name Judah. Mm. Then she stopped bearing. So the Lord gives Leah children. Leah finally catches a break and starts to give Jacob some sons. Mm. You know, it stirs her heart, and she at least has a little bit of hope. She's thinking, now my husband will love me, right? And, you know, we talk all the time about the sovereignty of God and taking note of how often he levels the playing field. Hmm. And, you know, we have to remember that if Jacob is to become a nation, he needs offspring, and he needs a lot of them. And so God's doing his part even then to start the family up, because he knows that things need to get moving, right? And Leah's sons are the firstborn of the family. And so who gets the birthright when there are two wives? In Deuteronomy 21:15, it says, if a man has two wives, one loved and the other unloved, and they have borne him children, both the loved and the unloved, and if the firstborn son is of her who is unloved, then it shall be, on the day he bequeaths his possession to his sons, that he must not bestow firstborn status on the son of the loved wife in preference to the son of the unloved, mm-hmm. the true firstborn. Mm. But he shall acknowledge the son of the unloved wife as the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. Mm. Wow, what a setup for future strife this is for this family. Right? But that's what God says. The first, mm-hmm. whichever wife it is, that's the one who's the firstborn. Amen. And, you know, the fact that this verse says the loved and the unloved has to be, I would think, a nod in Jacob's direction, saying, hey, you know, this is the way it's supposed to be. What happened? So, you know, and then Leah names her sons according to her hopes and her feelings. You know, she was... First of all, she was convinced because three out of the four, she says, well, the Lord gave me this child, right? So right away, she's acknowledging God for giving her these children and for opening her womb, basically. And the first is Reuben, which means, look, a son. And she hoped that this would cause Jacob to look favorably on her. And, of course, we know that it didn't really seem to do a whole lot.
How are they describing loved and unloved? What would be the actions of being unloved? How
would
that define?
Loved and unloved?
Is it being hostile to her?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say. I don't think there's a definition of that necessarily. But I mean, if you look at just for example, you know, a woman that they're married to and they're servant, and the husband has children with the wife and with the servant. Okay, the wife is the loved one, the servant is just the servant. So, you know, I mean, he was treating Leah, you know, really badly. He was ignoring her. It also said somewhere in there that, but he wasn't, he was spending more time with Rachel. Mm-hmm. And it says that somewhere. Yeah. It says, where's that? Somewhere in here. Then Jacob also went into Rachel, and he also loved Rachel more than Leah. So, I mean, it seemed like it was common knowledge that Rachel was the favorite one. He probably spent more time with her. They were probably walking around laughing and having a good time, and he probably ignored Leah a lot of the time. I mean, that would be my guess as to the telltale signs.
Probably spoke to Rachel a little differently.
Oh, yeah.
You know, gave her terms of endearment. You know, oh, I love you, and this and that, and Rachel, and Leah, oh, hey, what's happening, you know?
Well, he probably, you know, Rachel probably got the honeys and the cheers and the sweeties, and Leah probably got the wife do this, wife do that, wife do that.
How it worked.
Probably.
So, I mean, that would be, you know, it's sad, but it's true, right? So then, you know, she names the second Simeon, the Lord has heard. She believes God knew that she was unloved and that this baby would maybe cause Jacob to notice his mistreatment. Mm. And she was probably crying out to the Lord saying, do something to make this guy love me, right? Mm. And then Levi means joined to or attachment. And clearly hope is fading that these babies would bring Jacob closer because now she's not looking for love. She's just looking to be connected to him in some way. And then finally, Judah prays. She says, all right, you know, what can I do? I'm just going to praise the Lord. You know, give praise to him for what he's done for me. And, you know, and then Leah gives up, right, for now. She says, all right, I'm done. And, you know, she makes no plea for love or improved relationship with her husband. She's given up, you know, but though she might not ever enjoy Jacob's love, God has given her four sons, and she has that to be thankful for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you think about it, when you've got four kids, you know, what are you going to do? If your husband ignores you, you're going to pour everything you have into your children, right? Mm-hmm. And, truly, if Leah could see down the generations, she would have been amazed at how blessed she was.
Mm-hmm.
Because her last two sons, Levi and Judah,
mm-hmm.
would respectively father the priestly and kingly tribes of Israel.
Sure.
Leah's right. blood would flow in the veins of Moses, mm-hmm. Aaron, and David, and Christ.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And that's where we end the story tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Come back next week. Tune in and see the further adventures of Rachel and Leah. But, you know, it starts getting interesting next week because, you know, Leah obviously is a very jealous woman now that her sister has four children and she has zero. Rachel is jealous. Rachel is a jealous lady. Hmm. And, you know, she starts taking things into her own hands, which we've seen has been a dangerous thing in the past. But
it doesn't say anywhere how many years are between these
two. No,
children.
There's nothing to indicate the time that's passed. We don't know how old Reuben is. We don't know, you know, although we do see as they're having more children that some of the kids are doing things for their mom and things like that. In the next chapter, we'll see that. But time is passing. I mean, it's not a short amount of time, I don't think. And meanwhile, you know, this is during the 7 years.
That's right.
That.
So she's having that
Jacob
popping out.
Yeah. Now we don't know. By the time. I can just say this, but you know, as a preview, by the time 10 years passes, he has 12 children. So you know, so stuff's happening. But you know, we're only hearing right now about the first four.
So I watched a documentary.